Is called Mani Baragla. The person's running an animal, he doesn't move it with his hands, is Mani Baragla. And the Gemara says, Tre Gavni. The two ways to lead an animal, one is with your hands, and one is with your feet, sitting on top. You all know the end of Koheles compares Tamidei Chachamim to people that lead animals. So I always have to say in the Gemara, Mashal for life. So the Gemara talks about Tre Gavni Manhig, the two types of way you lead. We've spoken a lot this year about leadership. And sometimes you think about leadership in the overt sense, either in Torah or in community. Sometimes the truest form of leadership is Mani Baragla. We just lead a life that's worthy of inspiration, inspires people around you, and sit and learn Torah. So always keep in mind, Trei Gavni Mani, the two types of Mani. There's a Baragla, we're having a Baragla today, to have someone who's behind both forms of Hanhaga, Mani Biyada and Mani Baragla. Someone who has spent years and years learning Baruch Hashem Yoshev, Rabbi Svenemish Pesayim. In the Mir Yeshiva, also has a tremendous family connection. Some of you may know that four years ago, 4 years ago already. So, Nesson Sweet from Cal and Lopiansky's brothers-in-law and Lopiansky's father-in-law was the earlier Rosh Yeshiva, Danish Shinkel of the Mir. It's a really big schuss for us to have a Tom Chacham the year. Please, everyone, welcome to Lopiansky.
I guess another interpretation of Mani Baragla is that you have to run around a lot and go around a lot of places. I think I met Rabbi Tarragon being Mani Baragla in America many times, and he looked kind of literally Baragla. So I once heard, just nothing to do with this, but it's just such a powerful vart that I feel compelled to say it over. They once, the Panovich Rav, as you know, built up Torah in Eretz Yisrael tremendously, and he spent, I don't know, 90% of his time traveling, raising money. He did that in Panovich, and he did that here also. And someone asked him, what terrible avera did you do that this is your punishment to go from place to place like this, you know? I mean, he spent his life literally traveling. And he said, I think it's one of those powerful points in terms of chinuch. He says, you know, when you deal with Talmidim, you deal with nefashis. Thank God, I don't think the Mezer ever did something wrong. But b'shogeg, nobody can say that he's innocent. He says, golus is the punishment for nefashis b'shogeg. And when you're dealing in chinuch, you're dealing with nefashis. It's something, I mean, the yeshiva here has a very big chinuch piece itself, all sorts of mostos of chinuch and training people, and it's definitely a tremendous ideal to be involved in chinuch. And you know, helping to inspire the next generation of Tamir Chachamim and the Klal Yisrael, and bear in mind the responsibility. It's a wonderful ideal, and it's something to aspire for, but it's something that we always need to bear in mind. You know, every time someone tells me, and Targum, I'm sure anybody else who's a chinuch here, about a wonderful experience they had that was meaningful to them, you also begin to think, and who didn't tell you something that maybe turned you away, chas v'shalom. And again, it's always b'shogeg, but it's something to bear in mind for those of you who are so inspired to go and to spend your life in chinuch. Bear in mind its responsibility. Okay, I'd like to to talk about the Matan Torah. It's the parasha that we're sort of still holding it in a sense. And it's something that it's a fundamental in terms of all of Torah, is the approach to Matan Torah. I want to start with a Chazal over here and try to get a little bit into it. Famous Chazal, it's Gemara Shabbos, Peches, Peites, that when B'shoah Shalom Moshe Lamarim, Malach HaShar Eskenet Kodesh Baruch, and he said, Ribbono Shalom, what's a human being doing here? You know, this was Torah was around hundreds of years before, and so on. So, Ma'enosh Kisiskerena. So, HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Moshe, Hachzel and Tshuva, why don't you answer them? So, he said, I'm scared, they're going to destroy me. So, he said, hold on to my Kisei HaKavod and answer them. So, the famous answer, he told them, well, none of the Torah applies to you. You didn't go out from Mitzrayim, you weren't over the Avodah Zarah, you don't have parents, you don't have kinna, you don't have Yitzhahara, and so on. So, this give and take between Malachim and Moshe Rabbeinu, obviously, it's there to tell us. It's not a give and take. It's an understanding of something that's obvious. And Torah is an extraordinarily it's the noblest form of human existence of existence. And human beings are faulty, no matter what. And it really doesn't make sense that Torah should be given to humans as to fulfill Torah because they're really, really kind of a poor paradigm for it. But so what's the back and forth? So yes, we need it, we're Nebuch, we're Miskeim, but let's give a mashal. Imagine I'm shopping for gifts and I buy and I'm looking at a coat that's a few thousand dollars. Whenever my kids might so come to visit me, one of my kicks would be I would go up to New York, I'd take them to like a very expensive store to shop, and I didn't shop there, but I would show them, like, I remember one of my daughters saw a price tag on a shirt for $600, she flipped out. She, you know, so let's say I'm looking at that type of coat, and the coat's worth a few thousand dollars, and I say, I know who I have it for. There's this poor guy in town, he's very cold, and doesn't, you know, he's always shivering in the cold, this is a coat for him. That's pretty silly. He could do very well with a $150 coat that'll keep him warm, made out of, you know, some sort of polyester. And this coat, if I'm going for a gift, is going to be for a very wealthy man who, this is the type of thing. Yes, we need help desperately. Fine. But that's not who Torah should be given to. We could, if we want to, we could have access to it. We could get help. But the Malachim's taina is a very powerful taina. You're talking about a Kadosh Baruch Hu's sense of what's right and what's wrong. And what's, you know, and what's good and what's bad, and humanity should be the ones in charge of it. We also have the ability to paskin. We're the ones who decide what Torah is. So why is it? So Moshe Rabbeinu says, well, you guys, you're not so nebi. You don't have Yetzirah, you don't have kinah, you don't have sinah. But that's the bottom part of it. In other words, yes, the Torah itself includes halachas that deal with our frailties and shortcomings. But that begs the question. Torah could have just been given Kisvei Rizal, just deal with Olamos Elyonos, which we assume is the bulk of Torah. We assume that what we have in terms of these halakhas that deal with our frailties and shortcomings is the tip of the iceberg, and there's these massive, Kabbalah underneath it. So why are we the receivers of Torah? It's a very powerful time. And why did Kadosh Baruch Hu tell him, you answer? Like he was prepping Moshe. Like what was the back and forth over here? So that's the point that I would like to deal with. Another point. Moshe Rabbeinu was chosen to give the Torah and to receive the Torah and to be the Nosan HaTorah. The Torah points to one particular quality that Moshe Rabbeinu had. All of Torah, you have Moshe described as Ne'eman, faithful, that's sort of trusted. But the one midah that's defined is Anav mikol adam, humble. So it's nice, it's a very nice midah. It's a wonderful midah when you talk about midas, but one wouldn't expect it to be specially important or significant for someone who is receiving the Torah. I mean, many of our great intellectual accomplishments were made by people who we would have a hard time describing as anav, unless we seriously redefined the word anav. We would have a hard time describing them as anavim. So why? I mean, it's a great again. It's a great quality. I could hear somebody saying, despite that much of himself, but the Torah finds one quality, Avraham Avinu, that it is midas hachesed, and that you build class on chesed. We understand that. It's something that anivus is fine, but why would that be the quality? So I want to use a maral as a muscle, and I think we'll be able to get a sense of a piece that we're really missing here. The maral speaks about why is it that the halacha about Haggadah Pesach, Sipras Yetzer Mitzrayim, is bedafke bederach shaila tshuva. Not bederach shaila tshuva, it's halacha. You're not yotze unless you do bederach shaila tshuva. And even if you are sitting with yourself, you have to do it with bederach shaila tshuva. Why? What's the inyan of it? So Maral says, and again, more or less, I'm paraphrasing it a bit and sort of giving a little muscle, but it's the point that he makes. Imagine you have a table and a leg that's broken, or you have to attach a leg to a table. So you can glue it, you can hammer a nail in, and that's okay. Much better than that is you hollow out sort of a socket in the table, and you insert the leg, and then glue it or whatever it takes. Or if you're very good, you only need to do that. But that is a much preferred way. And the reason is, and again, I'm going to sort of use a little bit of a personification, but it's when something perceives itself as missing, what you insert becomes self. When you see something as extra, it always remains the superfluous. So when I have something that's extra, it sticks somewhat. When something is essential, so almost by the definition of the word essential means it becomes part of my essence rather than just being another piece. So long as the piece of wood is whole on its own, so to speak, it doesn't need the extra piece of wood. And so when you stick it on, it's added to it. And you can hold on to it tight, but you're holding on to something that's external to you. When you hollow out something, you've created a hole. You've created something that's missing. So now this piece that you inserted became integrated into it because that thing was missing it. If you want to look for another mashal, in a very deep way, Zachar and Akeva, man and woman, we can have wonderful friends, and friendship is wonderful. But the way in which HaKadosh Baruch Hu created man and woman is that woman fills in something that a person is missing. It's a world of difference. A friend of mine is a great addition to my personality. So it's me and my friend. But I existed before him, and I can exist without him. It's less good, it's less nice, but that's the nature of it. But a woman, when I woke up, I'm missing something. Emotionally, intellectually, everything. That's the way HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the description of the creation of Chava starts with taking something away from man. And so when man perceives a woman, he actually perceives something that becomes part of him because it really was him. So we have a setup, two relationships between two objects that need to connect. One is joining two things that each one exists wholly without the other one, and then you join it, or joining up something where you're missing something and the other objects becomes its fulfillment, its completion, its shleimus, and then you have a very different type of chibur. This is true intellectually, and this is what the maral means, why it is that we need to have the shaila tshuva. If somebody comes and I plant, adds a piece of information to my store of information. So, you know, either mizemanyen or I have the litany of all the different things that kids say, you know, okay, it's another piece of information that's floating around. Does it stick to me? You know, if I have a good memory, yes, somewhat. If I'm bothered by something, if something is bothering me, it means that I perceive myself missing a piece of information. And when the information comes, it fills a gap in my mind and then becomes part of it. It's not just another trinket sort of floating around and in my head. It's a piece that becomes integrated because it's missing it. It's like if you wonder about how something works, if you hear a science class about how something works, X, Y, Z, you know, you remember it as well as you remember it and as important as it is to remember it. But this is something always bothered you, couldn't figure out something. Now someone explains it to you, they will stay with you because you created the gap. You created the hole, or let's call it clay kibble for it. I want to just bring a parallel in a very different area, but it's the same halacha. It's Imam Psachim in halacha. In kashrus, there's a big difference between a vessel with smooth walls or chopped, chipped. Because when it's smooth, we'll assume, again, depending on the case, it's easier to say that something glides off it, whereas opposed to something that is chipped or has, like, you know, it's packed with holes, it will absorb stuff. It's one of the things when you do certain work at home. I don't do very much work now. I'm not very good at it, but I'm good at preserving it. So there are things you make these little holes in the wall, then you plaster whatever it is, and that the grooves keep whatever it is that you put on it. So anytime you have a hole and something that you fill in, that's something that sort of gives it the sticking power because of this phenomenon. That's true in many areas. Let's go and let's understand a little bit more about what Torah is. So we can look at Torah as following, and this is because people are naturally comfortable with themselves and feel good about themselves. So I start out saying to myself, I'm a great person, I'm a fine person, I'm a wonderful person. But I can always use a little bit of a hishtalmut. So Torah is definitely a beautiful top layer to my fine, pleasant, moral self. The Torah doesn't describe it like that. It says, "Vayal kimes kol she'asa b'nei tov mod vayer v'livoker yom hashishi." So in Brias Ha'olam, the final piece. The final piece of Brias Ha'olam before Shabbos, which is sort of a new phase of Brias Ha'olam, is Yom HaShishi. Rashi says, "Hoisif hei b'shishi, b'gmar ma'isa b'reishis, loma shehisnei mo'em al menashe kalva yisol chamishuchum shetorah. Dovacha, Yom HaShishi, kulom tluyim v'ondim ad Yom HaShishi, u'shishi b'sivan," and so on. What it means is HaKadosh Baruch Hu left creation with something, a gap, unfilled. It's not that it's a total creation, a wonderful world, Tov Ma'od, and now we're putting another layer of paint on it. It's something that the world is an unfinished world. And now I need to come in and to finish it. So Matan Torah needs to be perceived not as something given in addition to Brias Olam. It needs to be seen as the Gemara of Brias Olam. So just like if a person makes a Tanai, a person sells a house on a Tanai. So the sale hasn't been finished yet. It's not consummated until you fulfill the Tanai. You don't fulfill the Tanai, the Kinyan and everything you did is meaningless. The world itself comes, Brias Ha'olam left a gap. It wasn't finished. Similar to a man when there's a gap in his being and it's left to be fulfilled. So for Torah to be perceived the way it ought to be, it needs to be perceived as something that fills something missing, rather than a veneer that covers something that's already finished. So the Malachim came along, and they said, Torah, it represents HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Ratzon, it represents the most noble, a picture of a Bria Olam. Man being faulty and so on certainly is not the right candidate. HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Moshe, you answer it, because unless you express why you need Torah, then you don't get Torah. You need to express why do you need it. That's the key point. If we're talking about who's a better candidate to receive Torah mitzad as chshivs, of course the malachim are much more important. You need to come along and say, I'm more desperate for it because malach is a malach without Torah as well. He is what he is. I am not a human being without Torah. I'm missing. I have a yitzhara. I have a desire for ritzicha, for gneva. The Torah makes sense only if there's a possibility of ritzicha. Lo sinach makes sense for that. And lo sinach and lo san mecha yeshaka. So Moshe Rabbeinu says, yes, but if you give Torah in to people, it's going to land not as a nice extra, it's going to land in the kishkes. It's going to land where a person needs it. I was thinking, the word ma is an incredible word. The Maral says that the word ma adam is a gematria ma, quite simple gematria, 1 and 4 is 5, if you didn't figure it out, and the mem is the mem. And he says because Adam, his whole metzias is ma. In other words, unrealized potential. It's just like in Ma'ariv, the mahut is, what's his essence? What is he? So the malachim said it disparagingly about man. They said, ma enesh tiskrenu. He's a nobody. He is nobody. Moshe Rabbeinu said, ma enesh tiskrenu. Yes. But we're waiting. Having nothing is means that you have a kli kibul for getting something. A Talmud who comes in and knows it all, is nothing. No, you can't teach. But when someone comes in and says, I don't know anything, if the person, if that's what the person's understanding is, then he's waiting to learn. If that's his real perception of himself. So in the ma of it, And that's what I think. That's what Kodesh Baruch Hu said to hold on to the kisya kavod, because the kavod shemayim is realized dafka when if a brilliant Talmud comes and studies, and then he became a genius and came out a genius. It's very nice to say he's my Talmud, but at the end of the day, he's a genius. But if someone who came in and he's lacking something, he's not doing well, and I'm able to teach him, that's my covet, because it's me as a teacher, it's not him as a brilliant student. The kvod shema, the kisya kavod means, Adam, malachim say shira and they do kedusha and they're paradigms of perfection. But Adam's shleimus through Torah holds that kisya kavod. So we have over here an understanding that Torah needs a place to be chal in a person. It cannot be chal on something that sees itself as a davar shalei. That's why you find a Gemara, for instance, it says that Torah is nimshal l'mayim, that water goes from a tall place to a low place, because it's only when it's in a low place that it's a clay kibble for it. If it's in a high place, in other words, self-perceived as high, the water is excess. It just evaporates, it shakes off. It's only when is that there. It's something that we need to reflect on, because it's in a sense, for somebody who's a real Osek B'Torah, the big nisayon is the approach to Torah. Over the generations, there have been big people who, I would say very learned people, who've sort of floated away in different places. And almost always, this is the nekuda, because if you come in and say, without Torah, it's ma'enosh kisis kirena, I don't have anything. My own understanding and my own knowledge, it can serve well for discovering what a paper is made out of. But right and wrong, I was talking to somebody 2 days ago. He was talking about, somebody was having some issues. And he was talking about using logic to explore right and wrong. I said, what does that mean? What do you mean using logic to explore what's right and what's wrong? I said, every type of analysis includes axioms and a processing of axioms. So I start with certain givens, and I start with a certain elementary logical process, and that goes in. But right and wrong, do you mean to say that my personal feelings are the arbiter of right and wrong? That's it's beyond arrogant. So yes, a person needs to deal with it, and our sense of right and wrong is a sense that we're put in us. But to start with that, and it can't make sense because I don't think it's right. It doesn't feel right. I mean, so sometimes there's a way to learn pshat, which is honest and yes, when a person learns something, so we start with we do have other hanachas because we learned different sugyas and so on, and we can start with a question. But a person needs to have that basic sense of it. Moshe Rabbeinu's midah, more than anything else, was another. Torah works best when it fills up the greatest percentage of myself. And if something, and from it to fill the greatest percentage of myself, I have to come to Torah with a complete lack of self. And again, there are times, for instance, my Rebbe Reb Chaim Shalevis Van Vracha used to say, he had a very picturesque way of speaking, and one of his famous shmuzim about Akaras HaTov was, it says that Moshe Rabbeinu didn't hit the ocean, the sea, because of Akaras HaTov. So yes, but Akash Baruch told him to. So Chaim had a very picturesque way, Chaim Shalevis had a very picturesque way of describing it. He would say, Akaras HaTov is one of the midas shatorah nedreshes b'hem. That was the way he called it. So in that context, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's tzivui could have been directed to him. He could have done it through Aaron al Shulchan Aruch also. So you're in a sense, and HaKadosh HaTov is one of the things HaKadosh Baruch Hu was mechayev you. So okay, so now, but when a person says, I can't believe I know Mechias HaMolek, there's nothing, it is perfectly honest and correct to say, I struggle with it because I don't understand it. But my not understanding is not of value in saying whether it's right or wrong. If I start with a certain a priori assumptions that what I know and think is right, then I don't have a gap for HaKadosh Baruch Hu to put into it. And it's an important piece. It's something where the hachana for Torah is that a person is enough, that the person says, man has a sense of right and wrong, but he certainly is not the source of right and wrong. That I feel it's right or wrong is not why it's right or wrong. It's sometimes my sense, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave me that sense. I developed some sense when I learned. So it can, it's of important use. But I once heard a word from somebody. Shalom Yid on the street told it to me once, many years ago. And he told me, Al Shach HaKadosh. It says by David HaMelech that when he cut Shaul's claw, it says, Vayach Lev David. His heart skipped a beat, and he desisted, didn't do further. So the Al-Sheikh says, this is where the person told me, I never bothered looking at it, but I just remember the conversation, that's why. He said, David HaMelech's pulse was a pulse of Kedusha. And if his pulse skipped the beat, there was something wrong with it, even if he couldn't consciously identify it. It's like sometimes you have a professional, like a highly professional, let's say somebody who's a surgeon who's very experienced, and he begins cutting and says, no, I don't want to go further. Something's amiss. So that's appropriate because there's a certain intuition built on it. So a person who's learned a lot of Torah and is over Hashem, and then it comes to a gray area and he has a misgiving or a sense of something, it's meaningful because I'm drawing on what I feel or what might be felt as a Torah sense of something. But to walk in, first of all, the giving of Torah was to humanity because of its perception that it's lacking. Without Torah, we could be Ganovim, we could be Rotzchim, we could be many things. That's because we don't have the inner sense of it automatically to be it. Once we have that sense that we're waiting to hear from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so it means Torah doesn't come in as an icing on a cake. It becomes part of the batter of the cake itself. It becomes part of ourselves. It becomes integrated in us. Because we understand that moral fiber should be the core of our being, and we don't produce it on our own. We echo it sometimes. We mirror it sometimes. We don't produce it on our own. It's when HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives it to us and we absorb it as our basic sense of self, that's when we become the ma'enosh in the sense, in the positive sense. HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants people who see themselves as a big empty kli waiting to be filled. The more empty the kli is, the more missing it is, the more the filling becomes part of it. These are incredible years of your life where it's you know, you're learning the Torah that's going to be the basis for this your life. Whether some of you, Bez Hashem, will be zochah to be marbitz Torah in different formats, or whether you'll be osek in Torah der Heretz in various ways. Whatever you're going to do, these years, this year, two, three, whatever it is the basis for it. And the attitude that you start by saying, Hinein, I'm a kli waiting to be filled. It's the ma in us. It's the sense of potential waiting to be mismale that really makes us a kli for Torah. We should be zocha. We should produce that sense of humility for being able to incorporate Das Hashem. We should incorporate Torah and the Das Hashem and everything that the yeshiva provides for us, and thereby become a person whose Torah is integrated as the core of his personality. Matzlach. Yes, please. Yes, please. Except for Jacob, he has enough questions without the
Shir. That's a good point.
Tagging, you can start if you want. The boys are shy. They're very big Baal Dei Cheretz. They
tell us what it's like. A lot of boys, they haven't been exposed. They've been exposed to the yeshiva, like they were the yeshivas for us.
Right.
Before, maybe they may not know what it feel for learning here. It's a hard general question. And how many years did you learn that? You've given the
sense. Okay, so you know what? I think. I mean, my own personal sense of things, and I'll go out on a big limb for this one, is that there's a need for different shvatim to understand other shvatim. Only Torah is a very important part of Yisrael. Torah and Chayetz is a very important part of Yisrael. As long as people are doing things be'emes or be'yigia, and because they're looking for HaKadosh Baruch Hu and to do what they're supposed to in this world, and realize it with their own tafkid, there are many different important. Now, I want to, you know, I came from a background that was, I guess today would be called centrist. I mean, it was RJJ of the old RJJ, and Rabbi Ryan might still remember it. Where did you go, MTA? You went to RJJ? All right. Yes, he blazed the trail. Yes, we went camp together also, and we have a mutual pact that we won't say how many years ago, but he was a counselor and I was a camper. And right, and you remember, you and your brother were there. And which was considered in those days, the school served a sort of geographic area, except for you and your brother came from Far Rockaway. You have to pay two tolls going in and going out, right? See? I remember. There were many different influences. It was very unusual because today yeshivas tend to be a lot tighter around a certain ideology. In the yeshiva we had, I once wrote about this and the people couldn't believe, I wrote a hesked about a Rebbe of mine, Zeidel Epstein Zechariah Nevracha, who was he really was a formative experience. And I explained in my class, we had two Rebbes, children of Rebbes, a Rosh Hashiva's son, what you would call today black hat, a few, a handful, what you call the Maranatha Orthodox, a lot more. We had a Chabadnik, we had in Turkata, Nick Specher, I don't know if you remember, it was in Turkata. We had conservative rabbis, son, and non-Shomer Shabbos kids in one class. It was hard today to picture it even. I remember when I wrote it up for the Yatet, for the Hebrew Yatet, they couldn't get over it. They asked me again, are you sure? Are you sure? I said, yes, that's exactly what the class was like. And then Rebbe had to deal with that class. So I came from there and I went to the Mi Yeshiva straight. I was not 17 yet and I came to the Mi Yeshiva. For me, the experience, I mean, my Rebbe in the Mir was Rebbe Nachum, was cooler learning and brilliant, sort of open-minded. By the way, if you want to get a sense, for recreation, when I was in Yeshiva, we went to Herav Soloveitchik's Zman Bracha, the Artzeit Shir and other things, went to about Rebbe's Fabrengen's. I also went to Satmar Rebbe's Tish and other things. There was a very different world in that way. But I discovered a world where being Shakua in Torah becomes yourself, and it's genuine. Reb Nachum had nothing in his life but Torah, and it was incredible. It was an incredible experience to be part of it. I remember the idea of being absorbed totally, 24/7. And I'm going to share a personal memory of Reb Nachum because I guess this is what I can give over in terms. I've been in yeshiva a few months, and I went over with my chavrus to speak to him on learning. It was after my Reb Nachum had started having, he was sick with multiple sclerosis, but he was still walking around, but sort of wobbly a little bit. And after my he was standing with his back to the sfarim shelf, and my chavrus went over, and my chavrus was a big mitzvian. We were speaking and learning about mitzia, and I told him a sfarim rach of amani, same sugya you mentioned. I don't remember that I read it far. And he said a kasha, and then he said the point he wanted to say, had to explain it. And then he had a few, like a shtickle Torah, a few lefizes, like you can answer this, you can answer this. And I remember as soon as my chavrus said the point he wanted to make, Rav Nachum's face lit up, and he closed his eyes, and he began thinking. And my chavrus started cleaning, and he stopped him. And he just sat there a few minutes enraptured, like, wow, this is the perfect hezbah. It puts the suk. And there were 3-4 minutes of just enjoying the light of that svar. Not his. This is what a boy was telling him. And then he opened his eyes and said, what else do you want to compare? This? Okay, that works. This? Leave that. And this, that, and so on. But it was there was nothing else. Didn't talk about politics. Didn't talk about machshav either. It was kol kolo, baba kama, baba tia, baba bas, and that was it. And you know, I do have an interest in other things. But to me, that core experience that Baba Kama is where reality starts, reality finishes, is an incredibly important experience to put in a person's personal neshama. You know, the sense of sweating hours over a Reb Chaim and getting it down, and the fact that the mir was only that. And then the other thing, I used to go and Yom Tovim to hear Rav Hutner. I was very drawn to that. And, you know, I would go around sometimes. But that type of experience is a very core experience. And it's important that people have a taste of that type of experience. And that's why, you know, there's always a struggle, especially Shiva like here, where most people are not expected to stay a long time in Kollel. Do we prepare people for the nisyonos and the issues coming tomorrow and the day after? Or do we first give you a taste of what emes is? And you know, there was a certain sense of pure emes that's very hard to duplicate. I mean, Reb Nachum's personality was emes. There was no, if somebody said something that he felt, you know, cut off his, it tested his, he would sometimes say, you know, I'm beginning to have second thoughts if whether I'm right or not. He could also bash you. I mean, there was no, you know, Emes was Emes. He could let you have it, or he could draw back and say, you know, on second thought, I'm not sure that what I said is right, really. And he would walk away from it. Emes, he said he would. I'll tell you another experience about Reb Nachum. Reb Nachum lived underground. His apartment was a basement in the yeshiva that the army declared as fit for miklat. He certified as a McClack. That's how far underground it was. And there was a rack left there when he built the yeshiva. So they were short on funds as always, so they didn't excavate the whole rack. So in the middle of the living room, there was a rack. It was painted, but it was a rack left over from the that was the way he lived. He had nothing but that. The only thing he had was his Torah and his learning. And his Torah started to become very popular in Dubi. A certain Rosh Hashiva came, a person that whose personality left much to be desired, let's put it that way. Another wasn't one of his, and other areas weren't one of his. And he asked him to borrow his tapes, and those that had these big reel tapes, because they're learning whatever it was. So everyone said, sure. The person came back the next month and returned those tapes and asked for the next series. Rav Nachum's son was very upset. He had heard from many people that those shurim were being said over that person's name. The person was sort of, and that was before you could look it up, Google it, and see if where it came from. So he went to the other room and he whispered. Nachum said, "I'm not giving the tapes. He's stealing them. He's saying it over as his own shurim." Rav Nachum said, "Are you sure?" He said, "Yes." He said, "Fantastic. They'll know real pshat nesugya." and you know, it's that was him. He said, "What do I care? It's my name. I think this is Emes. And if this person says this over, this becomes this shit. Fantastic." Reb Nachum said many times, "I don't own my Torah. If it's Emes, it's Emes because it's Emes." It was incredible. And the ruach and learning was like that. It was, you know, if al tassel pid var Emes. So it's something that, you know, the so-called hashkafa. That Olam HaYeshivas, it was never given openly, I would say. It was never talked about. In the Shmuzer, Rav Chaim spoke mostly about the Another Mechavero. That was his big theme. But there was a sense of just, it was unthinkable a person with anything but sit and learn, kind of. So it's an important, unfortunately today, things tend to become either or, us against. And you know, and it's lacking because people in that world need to understand the issues and the struggles of people who are outside, people who are practicing medicine at a very high Ramah in a very important place, and the struggles and the struggles are not so easy, and the people who spend their lives doing it need to understand the certain Kedusha of it, and everyone's able to understand how Baba Kama, the word Kedusha, could be just another Kama, and it is, it was. So that's, I guess, if I just to share a personal, I got a little bit off tangent, but that's where I'm coming from. That's, yes. Yes.
I had the school of learning a few of the Shmuzid in the Sikh Musa, which I think is really Mamish involved with stuff.
What's your name, by the way?
Ari Kranit from Ranana. Ari Kranit
from Ranana, yeah.
I hear people talk about Rav Chaim Shmulevitz, and the Shmuzid were like world famous, and
yes.
His book, The Sikh Musa, was published by
right.
Finkel, if I'm not mistaken. I'm really trying to stop in Iraq. Rosh Hashiva talked a little bit about Kashmir Levitz, and as a Rosh Hashiva, as a leader,
yes.
From Shanghai to Israel.
So I don't. I mean, he was my wife's. He was uncle by. When I came to Yeshiva, so let me explain. When I came to Yeshiva, kind of was a little more distant. He was older. He was after a stroke, so he couldn't hear, and he also was very. There was a certain years I covered. Reb Nachum was very accessible. Reb Chaim was years covered. But Reb Chaim and Shmuzin were very powerful. They were. What's an amazing thing is, by the way, I can share a piece that's missing. Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, as a bacher, did not have much interest in Musa. He was all learning, and you know, he didn't go for Musa as Musa. That was, and he had to say Shmuzin because the Mashkiach had been nifter early in yeshiva, and they didn't have somebody. He became more known for that than for Shmuzin. It's amazing. I'll say a word on Yisro that he said, he used to say, and I think it explains him a lot. He used to say, Vayishma Yisro, the wrong translation of that word is he heard. He said everyone heard. And the words he said was, Vayishma Yisro is erhot derher. Now, the word der Herr doesn't have an easy English translation, that's why I said it in Yiddish. There's Herren, which means to listen. Der Herren means to get it. It's like, you know, it's like I explained before about, it's like when something goes in one ear, one out the other, that's listening. When you get it, when it hits you. Reb Chaim's, one of his great kohos, I think there were two tremendous kohos in his shmuzin. As much as he was a phenomenal masmid, he understood life. And people complained that the shmuzim were not geared to the yeshiva, but guys coming late for seder, guys doing this, do that. But 40 years later, I begin to understand. He spoke about life and gave us like yisodos on life. They're incredibly understanding people. The second thing was, he was able to feel situation, and you wonder how he was able to. Let me give you two examples, just off the top of my head. I don't know if you've been here, most of you've been here Shavuos or not. But on Shavuos morning, as opposed to America, where they lay in Rus the second day, they lay in Rus the first day here. So the reading of Rus is the universal time for everybody to get a nap, because it's a long night. For davening is standing. For those who've been here, I see I'm nodding. So I guess that's that. And Reb Chaim would stand and sob. You know, you can't think of Rus Echas for sobbing, maybe Koheles, but Rus. And Reb Chaim would sometimes speak, and he would say, "Don't you hear the story? A woman who was a princess is scrambling for alms for the Davis. This is, she gave up everything to be able to scramble for the Leket and Shikha." He's picturing, he was able to picture it and see a woman who was at the top of her society, royalty, reduced to a beggar because of her love for HaKadosh Baruch Hu and Torah and for Emes, to give up so much. You know, does the person have it? That was one example of how he was able to hear and to feel that. He would tell over stories sometimes about his brother went to buy a pair of shoes for a kid, and he was able to live the emotional the what was going through the person emotionally in incredible ways, and it came through in a shmuz where you learn to sense what. There's one about a Amalek. I'll tell you the story also. I guess it's not a Friday night dish, but I guess we. There was a story, somebody in the mayor was doing something that didn't fit what the yeshiva would expect in terms of it was in terms of what the person was doing. Also, no Averis, but whatever it was something that the person was involved in that didn't feel, and somebody wanted to throw him out and something like this and that. And Reb Chaim spoke. And it's funny, he said three nekudos, but the one I want to focus on is the following one. Everybody talks about Amalek, how bad he is, how wicked he is, how he's this, how that, now, and his pure ra and enriches itself, and so on and so forth. Reb Chaim said, let me explain to you where she came from. It says, Timna, the Pelegesh, want to be Mizdabek Bezara Shel Avram. And Avram, I guess she wasn't the caliber to Mizdabek. Avram wasn't taken for a Shidduch. So she went and married Eliphaz, and they had Amalek, the Chazal. So he said, she is the embodiment of a person rejected. And when a person is rejected, there's no boundaries to where a person will go to. He said, I will never give a hand to rejecting somebody. Unless you can show me that the person, if he's a bad influence on someone else, I have no choice. But he said, to reject somebody outright, I'll never do that. And I don't care if people leave the yeshiva. But to be able to understand how terrible rejection of a person. And he said it about Shaul HaMelech. It says when Shmuel told Shaul HaMelech, you've lost your malchus. You disregard by Hashem, you lost your malchus. So Shmuel told him, so Shaul said, Kabdeini no neged zikyamcha. Could you please escort me out and do a little hail to the chief? He says, was he crazy? I mean, he'd just been told that he's gone. He's lost. He lost it all. So he wants another hail to the chief. What did Shaul want? So Reb Chaim said, Shaul knew that if he were to feel rejected, everything would go. Everything would go. Because a person can't live with that. He needed to hold on to something desperately. And that's why Shmuel agreed to it. And the understanding what it feels like to be rejected, it was incredible. And Reb Chaim was very passionate. And when he spoke, the place shook. And it was genuine emotion. That was what Reb Chaim's shmuzim were like. I was the one who translated them, actually, together with the AS over there was a pen name of mine, because I didn't feel comfortable with Shaito. So I did the translation, and Elimelech Klugman did the editing. Much more the editing. It's because of the editing that it's good. But it was, you know, it's very hard because it was almost, Reb Chaim was such a brilliant intellect, and in learning was all learning, and he could learn for hours and days at a time, but he had tremendous passion, emotional sensitivity. That was a very, it was an incredible combination. Yes. Yes. What's your name? Just ask.
From where?
Detroit, Michigan. Yeah.
So we hear a lot about the size of the mirror.
The what?
The size of the mirror. How many people
yes.
are there? I want to know what type of impact that has on your learning in such a large group of Josh. Was it a significant aspect of it?
So when I came, there were 300 people in the Beis Medrash, which in those days was a lot. In those days, I don't think we understand the exponential increase. The generation after the war probably had 30 people in yeshiva, 40 people in yeshiva. That was considered a big yeshiva. Tells had 30, 40 when it started. It was a big yeshiva. When I came to the Mir, 300. Ponovich, Lakewood, and Chevron probably have 400 apiece, and but Asulk seemed quite huge. And there's something about the power and the energy of so many people learning together. I don't know. I have my own hesitations about when something becomes too big, you lose. I mean, I could speak to enough from learning anytime I wanted to. I had to take the risk of him yelling at me, but other than that, he was there, and he was very approachable. And Reb Chaim, I knew, I'd spoken to him a few times. I could tap a younger man who was an Adam Gadol sitting on a bench next to me and ask him for something, you know, chat or whatever it was. When it becomes very big, I wonder, I'm frightened at the idea of it being thousands of people. And it's just proportionately, you've lost that sense of Rebbe and so on. But there is a certain element of having the energy of so many people focused on something. So there's a balance between having it personal enough and having certainly a few hundred people in an environment where everybody's learning and osik in the same sugya is very, very powerful. That's a certain kol harabim. But I have my own wonder. I wonder if you're not losing that sense of a personal rebbe, which I think is very important. I mean, the big yeshivas in Europe, and Mir had 400 in Europe, and it was the giant yeshivas, Sabotka had 300, 400. There's a book, actually, somebody put out, I think it's called The Oz Over Something, a fellow Kublyansky, he's a from person, Betsy Kublyansky, he put out about European yeshivas between the wars. Very scholarly, it's a very great work. It's basically facts and figures, numbers, where the money came from, when places opened, closed, what is very, very... An extremely good balance between being very objective and academic without inserting any of his own personal feelings. Just maps out the different combination, how the war affected it, how World War I. But the numbers are all the amount of yeshiva bachurim in Europe, what, 2,500 maybe in Litvish Europe, in White Russia, in Litva, and the part of Poland that belonged to that part. And you know, Sidim had a very different dynamic. They didn't have yeshivas really, but in terms of that, it was. I don't know. It's a big thing to be able to learn a big tzibur. You know, I encourage boys by us in yeshiva to spend at least a zman in the mir, like just to get a sense of having that power of a rabbim. But I wonder at what point should it become more units rather than just a humongous unit. Yes.
What did you have to take for your bechina to get into the
mir? To the mir?
Yeah.
I told Reb Nachum Shtigl Taira. And it's interesting. I told him two things. I was young. I was not 17 yet. I just gone down. It was a mistake. I thought I had a cousin, and I figured there were no American yeshivas those days. Nothing existed. I think Karen Biavner might have been one. I knew one boy had learned the Bayakvan American, and I knew one boy had learned Farsidim. That was it. I came as a young boy, and in retrospect, I'm kind of horrified. So I told him over a shtickel of my own, which he dismembered. He was not happy with it. I told him over Reb Shimon, not a big thing, but I think he was pleased with the way I said it, and that was like the basis for But they would, Demir, it's interesting. Demir in Europe was very selective. I don't know if it was because of money or because the Shita was like that. In Eretz Yisrael, they were desperately trying to build up. They were more inclusive. You know, they would give you a little bit of a hard time if they felt you weren't serious and so on. They would sort of try to tell you, you know, try somebody else. You want to be, and why can I help you? I think in the end, they just wanted to, there was nothing doing. They weren't, you know, they I think their sense was, Eis Lasis Lashem. But I never was able to understand which was the Iker, which was not. I don't know, something I wonder about. I had one opportunity to ask. Demir had a secretary of Yosef David Epstein, or J.D. Epstein, who some of you might have known from Belgium. He was an incredible person. And he wrote some very important Sparim, Mishpat HaShalom, and things like that. His son just passed away as a Chaim Leib Epstein, a very chashuv Likud Rosh Hashiva, from that circle. I once spoke to him, I asked him, I want to ask you a question. Was the mirror shita that they should take everybody except they didn't have the money in Europe or space or anything? Or was the shita to be selected? But after the war, you needed to build up a new director. He said, my father's biggest midah was confidentiality. He was the secretary of Blaise Yudel, and he didn't speak a word. He told me, he said, my father, J.D. Epstein, had told me that there were two things that Blaise Yudel told him that changed his life, and he never wanted to tell me what they were. He never spoke about this either. And he took his understandings to this grave. I don't know the answer to that. It was something that they were. By the way, in New York, I give the b'chinas for the mir. So one of the things about the mir, I always say, my brother-in-law asked me 4 or 5 years ago, when it was things got difficult for him. And it was very hard to travel. So he asked me to fill in temporarily. So it's been a while. And I always tell people the three most memorable people that took the chinas of the mir that I remember. One was a Satmar Chassid. One was somebody from Lakewood. And one was somebody from Gush. He's today, I don't know, I could say it, I guess, but I don't think much. Today he's a son-in-law of a very chashuv shiva in New York. And I was blown away. He told me, "Shtikon Yevamis." I was floored. So that's the mir. There was a Satmar Chassid. There was a voice. And he told me, this fellow, he told me, I was in YU for Shabbos. We ate together. I schmoozed with him. And I told him that, you know, I'll tell you that three people are impressed, and that's the mir yeshiva. So he told me he was sitting in the dining room of yeshiva, talking to an Israeli bacha who had learned in Brachfeld and was down the mir, a Sephardi boy. And he said, I was thinking to myself, we're so different. He's Sephardi, I'm Ashkenazi. He's Israeli, I'm American. He's wearing a black hat, I'm wearing kippah suga. But Yevamos is Yevamos the same. And we both have the same geshmak Yevamos. And that was one of the things that was very unique about the mir. They very much, you know, they certainly belong well within the yeshiva camp and that gudah, so to speak. That was but it never was a topic. I mean, it was, you know, it was learning and being serious about the learning. Being Rabbi Shapir Rappaport was, when I came, he was one of the older Bachram, was there for many, like 3-4 years at least. And he was part of the Chavur of Reb Chaim. It was interesting. And the mir was a very big doggish on learning. And Ehrenskeit, they valued if a person was serious or a person was frivolous or, you know, if he wasn't a good person because there was something wrong with his person. Arrogant, frivolous, something like that. They would cold shoulder a person. But if the person was emes and snap, it was unique. I don't know. That was quite the.
Well, what type of bechina do you give now?
You'll get a discount. If you. it's usually the customer is the teyobah shtekel tyra, and then I ask him to learn something inside. They're trying. The mir wanted, the shita of Nosson Tzvi put into place was, we want to be as open to as many people as possible, but someone who's not going to make it because he can't, or because he's, or because the person, you know, they also check up, they've learned that they want a person that has the ability, the skill to make it, and the rutzen to make it. That's really what, but Torah should be for everyone. In other words, the Torah should be for elite. Is puzzle. That was, in other words, that was the antithesis of it. I want to tell you, once we're speaking again, I guess we're just sort of open conversation. This is a story that someone told me 3 weeks ago. Somebody came to my house. Somebody called me up in Silver Spring, and he said, I'm in the U.S. Army. I'm stationed for a few days in Bethesda, and I would like to speak to you. Okay. So I said, come. So he came down, a very firm-looking guy, a person who's, he looks kind of very, I guess, a modern person, but, you know, mannerisms and definitely learned in yeshivas, learned in the mirror in New York, learned in the mirror in here. He was in his mid-30s. He had been in two careers, and he had been in the U.S. Army for quite a while. He was a chaplain, and now there was a career change, and he had certain things he wanted to discuss. But he told me about his background, his life, and he said for many years he had been a social worker in South Dallas, which he explained to me, like, Gehenna does not have lower Maduras than South Dallas. He said, what Katrina washed up ended up in South Dallas. He said, you won't even, and he said one of his struggles was to retain an identity of self in that situation. You're dealing with people that, I mean, Sodom and Amora are sort of kala lehem, as they say, you know, katana lehem, you know, and so on. So he said, do you know what kept me? And this blew me away. He said, he learned the Yeshiva for a few years. He was close to Rav Nosson Zvi. Rav Nosson Zvi was a person who was able to reach out to many people. He came back to America, got married, and came back to learn in the Yeshiva. He said, I ended up learning only a few months. But when I walked in, Rav Nosson Zvi saw me. He had a big smile on his face, and he said, welcome home, Zvi. And he said, that welcome home, Zvi, is what I hold on to. You know, I was taken by the story. It's not an unusual story of Nosson Zvi, but to hear it from somebody, you know, coming real, it was for me. And I guess it was for all of us, holding on to a yeshiva, holding on to a mocha. And in yeshivas, it was common. It's one of the things that, unfortunately, again, I see this as a mile in all my yeshivas. People will come back to yeshiva for Shani and Kippur. People will call up a yeshiva. A yeshiva is not a school that there was a segment in your life and you passed on. It's not a school. It's where you are. And holding on to it, keeping a kesher rebbeim, coming back for a yontif, spending yachakalas. I'm staying at the in Prima Palace. And they have so a whole group of 25, 30 Lakewood Balabatim people are working. They come for a week with a Rebbe to sit and learn. Meir Yeshiva has yachakalas. They have 80, 90, 100 people that come. They go for a week. And it's more than what you learn in those 3 or 4 days. It's you're part of yeshiva again, and that's something that I think needs to become part of this setting. Of you know, a yeshiva is not a shana aleph and not shana bet shana gimel. It's a lifetime. You spend a year or two, but rebbeim and baruch Hashem, you know, they don't need to tell you know, you have a wonderful staff, you have people that are here. It's you have shrushim here, and they did to come to yeshiva for yom neroyim. Those are things that give a different perspective on life, and you know, it's something that is you know, life is tough. Everyone here is idealistic, and everyone here is very turned on. But there's a long tikkun afterwards when you're in a very different world. You're immersed in a different world, different values, different society, and holding on to reality, holding on to emes is very important. And I see it. I mean, our yeshiva deals with boys who come back from Eretz Yisrael. You know, more yeshivish crowd and but are people that are into professions and I after 20 years I said how important it is to feel that you still have a hand, you know, that there's still a hand to reach out to whenever you want, wherever you want. It doesn't have to be for major things. Just feeling that you're part of connecting, reconnecting, coming for shots, coming for something. You know, it's absolutely essential. Yes.
Why does Rebbe choose to live in a smaller community like Silver Spring when if Rebbe moved to New York or made Aliyah, Rebbe could make arguably larger difference?
You know, I guess you get stationed and you don't have all of the input where you get stationed. You know, there were many factors where my feeling was this is where I was stationed. I lived 25 years in Israel, and when I finally, for 6 years, I commuted to Silver Spring because I couldn't to make a decision to move. But when I did, I met a Chinuch Zabayis, and I spoke and I said, I don't understand, like, how am I making a Chinuch Zabayis for a house in Chutz La'aretz when I had a house in Yerushalayim and so on. And I said, you know, my feeling is, I gave it much thought, my place in life is Shevet Levi. And we're, it's like an army. It's what's kavua is not the physical location, what the job you're doing. And if this is, if my feeling was, you know, my feeling, I spoke with Rebbeim, that this is the right place, then this is where I'm posted. I don't belong there. It's not, you know, it's, I belong doing what I'm supposed to do. And, you know, I hope I made the right decision for that. But it's, you know, Pesha Me'ah, Pesha Yisuk. Chaim used to say it all over the Hoyle, the Gemara says that because of Hashem Yahu Hashem Yisu, it's Kemanda Kvi, though. It's a certain Kvias when you feel that way. I know. Yes?
I was talking a lot about, maybe you also mentioned how you used to go to Satma, Zitzu, Slavichik. That's a little bit like how you see all the various outside influences, like outside of the...
This, you know, if a person has no place that he belongs to, he's rootless. If a person is closed into his place, there's sort of a what you call it? It's very dry and you know, I like I said, the mayor was me and that was fit me and that was my roots. I had an interest and I felt I could get things and, you know, sometimes more, sometimes less, but it's my person, it's my nature of it. Reb Hutna has a very fascinating letter. And again, I hope I can give over you have to catch the flavor of it. Reb Hutna was broad as they come, extremely broad person. And his whole genre of machshava was kind of a bit alien to much of the yeshiva world. And many people were swept up by it. But so someone wrote him a letter that doesn't get what's it all about, what he needed for. Reb Hutna wrote, answered him. The person wrote back a second time that he doesn't get it. And so on. And Reb Hutna explains. And then he writes at the end, I put down a beautiful turn of phrase. He says, and if I still haven't succeeded explaining to you why this is necessary, you're right. You don't need it. You can do without it. The Koran Yalecha, Mitzamek V'yafalo. In other words, Mitzamek V'yafalo is a halachic terminology. When you cook on Shabbos, so at a certain point, the food, instead of cooking more, begins to dry out. Sometimes when it dries out, if you happen to like dry junk, it's approving it. So mitzamek means to become dried out, to desiccate, and to be yofalo means this. So he said, you know, for some people, this is your personality, this is all you need, and it's good for you. You know, I did have an interest in seeing other things and exploring other things and getting from other things. But, you know, but it's important to have a core sense of who you are first and foremost, and everything else becomes a broadening of the person. Okay, it's a fascinatingly, very interesting, you know, I see people have a lot of interests, and like I said before, never substitute floating and flirting in other places for working and self-learning, but if you work on your core and sit and learn solidly, and you see other worlds, other places, other things, that there's what to gain from, then it's, you know, it's a wonderful addition, and use your years well. Like I said before, I really think it's important. I think it's one of the mindset of I think yeshivas like this need, and I hear, well, Gush actually has a whole settlement around it, and people who live here have roots in yeshiva. It's a very important part of yeshiva to understand. You need to put it, it's a place for life. You're not going to be in yeshiva for life, but it's Chaim in Machzikin Bo, holding on to it, bring your kid here. You know, one of the things I haven't, you know, I'll ask sometimes, some head of affair, who's your Rebbe's Rebbe? I'm a ghost at how many people don't know. What do you mean, who's my Rebbe? You know, the stories of Chaim Nachum are not stories. They're me. This is me. And it would be unimaginable. I could tell you exactly who Reb Chaim and who Reb Nachum's Rebbe were, because that was, they didn't tell stories during Shia, but that was part of it. You know, understanding that no matter where you go from here, this is the shoresh, is the key to taking it with for life. Okay. Thank you.